Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Prince and the Parade and Sign of the Times Era Studio Sessions, 1985 and 1986, by Dwayne Tudall. Foreword by Sir Elton John. Narrated by Ron Butler. Foreword. The first time I met Prince was at a party after the Grammys in a restaurant in L.A. He was standing alone by a wall, so I went up and introduced myself to him. "Hi, my name's Elton, and I'm a huge fan of yours, and I just wanted to say..." And that was as far as I got. Prince just walked off without a word. As you can imagine, that was quite a deflating experience. But I knew how shy he was. Everyone knew how shy Prince was. And I loved his music so much that a few years later I tried again. I went backstage when he was playing his residency at the Rio in Las Vegas, and I was doing the same at Caesar's Palace. He'd got the hotel to build him his own nightclub, Club 3121. Everything painted purple. And I'd see him driving around town in a Bentley on which the paintwork turned purple when the sun hit it. This time, he asked me to play on stage with him that night. He wanted me to sing the Beatles' The Long and Winding Road. I told him I didn't know the words. He said that he didn't either, and he had them written out on the floor of the stage. So I went on stage with him, and we started playing The Long and Winding Road. It sounded great. Midway through the song, I looked around. No Prince. He'd just walked off again. Clearly, my experience wasn't entirely unique. There are plenty of other examples of Prince's improbable behavior in this book. You could see them as being the result of rudeness or nervousness, but I prefer to think that Prince was just off in his own world, one that no one else could really comprehend. He reminded me a lot of my late friend Mark Bolan, and not only because Prince was clearly a big fan of Mark's band, T-Rex. If you want to know how big a fan, just listen to Cream, then play T-Rex's Get It On, or Bang a Gong, as they called it in America. It was that they were both incredibly charismatic, but somehow otherworldly, as if they'd come from another planet and were just passing through Earth en route to somewhere else. There was something at the center of them you could never fully understand. This book covers part of Prince's great moment, when he was writing one incredible song after another. Every major artist has one, the period where they're on a roll, where they can't seem to do anything wrong. But Prince's great moment seems slightly inexplicable and unearthly, too. Even more so when you hear about it in the kind of detail contained here. The sheer number of tracks he wrote and recorded, the speed at which he worked, the perfect simplicity of a song like Kiss or Sign of the Times, the incredible taste and subtlety of his arrangements, the way you watched as his influence spread throughout pop. I used to listen to his albums with my mouth hanging open. How had he done it? How did he make doing it look so easy? I felt the same way watching him live. I've never seen anyone with that degree of control over his audience, with that ability to manipulate a crowd. He was a very modern artist. He used the latest technology. He did something completely new. But in another way, he seemed strangely old-fashioned. He was part of a tradition, maybe the last in a tradition, of African-American artists that could do everything, that were demanding, that put on a show where every aspect was perfect, the playing, the backing vocals, the moves, the clothes, without losing any sense of spontaneity or excitement. You could trace a line back from Prince through James Brown, Little Richard, even to Duke Ellington. I'm not sure that I've seen or heard anyone I could say that about since Prince. I got to play with him one more time, in London at the O2, during his 21 Nights in London residency. He asked if I'd play The Long and Winding Road again, and this time he stayed on stage throughout. It was a real thrill, as exciting as playing with John Lennon or Bob Dylan or Ray Charles. But then, watching Prince perform that night from the audience was just as thrilling. It was one of the greatest performances I've ever seen in my life. When he passed away, I said that we all knelt at Prince's feet, and I meant it. I like to think that if you're a real musician, you recognize quality when you see it. But you didn't need to be a musician to recognize that in Prince you had quality that was extraordinarily high. You just needed ears and eyes. Elton John, January 2008. 2021. Preface. What's the use in half a story, half a dream? Lyrics from The Ladder. Everything starts with a need. In the 1980s, we needed Prince. We didn't realize it, but we did. If you don't think so, imagine the 80s without him. No Purple Rain. No 1999. No Prince sitting naked on the cover of Love Sexy. Okay, we didn't need that one, but we wanted it. We wanted someone to slap us upside the head with a funky bass line or shock our senses with a song that had no bass line. We needed that because in many ways, music had gone stale, and there was little danger left. We needed someone to threaten the status quo, but also to push us to get off our asses and dance. We needed someone to remind us of the power of funk, the unbridled joy of riding a greasy groove and earning the sweat from dancing all night to a pounding thump you could feel in your core. Prince brought that danger in so many ways. According to Eric Clapton, this is someone who was a reincarnation of Little Richard, Jimi Hendrix, and James Brown in one. I thought that's exactly what the world needed. When one of the greatest guitarists of all time explains the need for Prince, you take notice. I started writing the first book in this series because I needed to tell his story. But as I wrote it, I realized that it was also the story of the people that Prince handpicked to be near him. These select few were important because they were there at his side when he created some of his most important music. And just like writing a song, writing a book is a lot of work, and 1,000 obstacles will block it from being finished. Books don't get done until someone feels the need to write it. Once I finished the first volume, I realized that, although it was a complete story, his story wasn't finished being told. Which brings me to this book and the other half of the dream. Wait a minute. Supposedly sequels never live up to the original. Well, this isn't really a sequel at all. It is the second half of Prince's story while he was working with the Revolution. The first book in this series was about the rise of Prince and the birth of the Revolution, and how vital they were to Prince's success, and how deeply involved in his work they'd become. But that was only half of the story. The second half explains how he opened himself up to them, showing his truth and vulnerability, which fueled his creativity, energizing him to fashion what many consider to be his most inspired album, Sign of the Times, and it starts with him at the peak of his popularity. This isn't the story of Prince's impact. We all can see that in ourselves, because you wouldn't be listening to this if he didn't influence you in some way. But this book is about his contributions to his music, and more accurately, what parts of himself were exposed, because there is a lot of Prince in his art. His songs were a combination of diary, observation, and confessional. Prince wore many masks and didn't reveal himself to his fans. There were glimpses, but he seemed to enjoy the mystery and the playful deception we accepted from him. Not that he was tricking us, but he was using every chance he had to reveal just enough about himself to keep us interested. A clever smile here and a raised eyebrow there said a lot from a man who refused to talk. He was always protective of his story because the missing pieces kept us intrigued. But as enjoyable, or frustrating as that was, his life took on bigger meaning when we lost him as early as we did. Bruce Springsteen eloquently reflected about Prince's passing and said, "Any death gives you renewed sight. It's a part of what the dead pass on to us, a chance to look at our lives and look at the world again." Personally, I want to know more about him because it takes his music to a different level and gives us a chance to add to his legacy. I want people to learn how he did it, but it is also vital to know why, because why questions are the ones that open doors that reveal the character inside of Prince instead of the character we know as Prince. "I think that you can't understand his music unless you understand the man," reveals his former fiancée, Susanna Melvoin. "I think that everyone's interpretation is valid of him as the musician, but to really understand the music is to understand who he was. Not many people got that chance." Although this book has been in the works for years, Months were spent working alone in our collective isolation of 2020 due to the pandemic. Not seeing those we care for or having that healing touch from a loved one has forced us to use a part of ourselves that came to Prince naturally, because being alone in his recording studio and muting out the world allowed him to give birth to his art and share his intimacy in a way that he often struggled with, according to many in his life. Isolation for him wasn't a hindrance, explains Susanna. Isolation was a time for him to communicate what he needed to say. So music and isolation were his language. Today, we need Prince at the exact time we know he isn't available. We need that escape, and we need the unity of his fams/fans. We need to wave our arms slowly to the woo, woo, ooh, ooh of Purple Rain. We need to stand shoulder to shoulder with the others who share this experience, remembering that his music touches every race, gender, sexual identity, and religion. It virtually wipes out what keeps us apart and finds the commonalities that connect us to one another because we are all part of one huge family, and our family has lost its leader. Because we can't have him, we need those who knew him to remind the world that he was and still is important. This book is Prince's story told through the prism of his time in the recording studio and the part of him he wanted us all to know, his music. I don't want to deify him. In fact, it is even more intriguing when you know his achievements in the framework of his journey. It is infinitely more impressive that a man who has gone on record about feeling kicked out of his home as a child was able to focus his energy on creating the wealth of music that he did. As a person, he wasn't perfect by any standard. He was a flawed man who recognized that his calling was music, and he labored to become the best musician possible. Yes, his story will contain heartbreak, pain, loss, and failure, but there will also be resurrection, joy, and a legacy of music that continues to inspire millions. Despite all the chaos, that is a lesson for everyone. There's even more to this genius than you realize, explained his engineer, Susan Rogers. And the true story of who Prince was and what he did during his lifetime is a story that needs to be told and shared and understood. Listening to a good song is like a journey. Listening to a great song is like a journey with your best friend. I hope that some of these personal recollections by those who were in the room with Prince help create a great journey for you, because the music in this book covers not only some of Prince's best work, but also some of the best music anywhere. So open your heart and open your mind, and please go find this incredible era of music in your collection and relive it with a great set of headphones. If you don't have this music, buy the albums, CDs, or individual songs, and listen as you listen to this book. Knowing the passion and stories behind this incredible period will make it much more intimate, almost as if he's revealing his life to you through his music. Hopefully, this will give you a new appreciation and perspective as you listen again for the first time with new ears. My greatest wish is that this book puts you in the room when these sounds were born, and lets you feel as if you were sitting next to the maestro, whose rigorous training and skills make it appear as if he is pulling music from the air. And please share this experience with someone from the next generation and watch the echoes of his sounds and the ripples of his influence spread as far as possible. Let them know that once there was a man named Prince, and after he stepped up to the mic, music was never the same. Prince said, "Like books and Black Lives, albums still matter." I hope that books like this help fill a little of that need and remind us all to celebrate and dance. We need to dance. January 1985. There's not much I want the public to know about me, other than the music. Prince. Prince knew that expectations were high for his next move. A new year and a new mountain to conquer. Purple Rain had not just happened, it had exploded. Although that seems obvious in retrospect, few knew how big the movie, the album, and Prince would become once it was launched. The naive dream of success from a child who had moved from home to home was not only realized, but it was also achieved, and the days of being underestimated were in the rearview mirror. He had created an industry, and with that came responsibilities to those around him. With his career-defining album, Purple Rain, still holding number one pop album on the charts, and would for a total of 26 weeks, and the other three albums he produced, Ice Cream Castle by The Time, The Glamorous Life by Sheila E., and Apollonius 6 by Apollonius 6, were at 34, 47, and 134 respectively. The movie had been released on home video in the United States on November 16, 1984, and reached number one on the Billboard Top Video Cassette Sales Chart and on the Billboard Top Video Discs Charts, and number two on the Billboard Top Video Cassette Rentals Chart. The press was knocking at his door for interviews, information, and insights, but Prince maintained his distance and his mystery. According to those around him, Prince was physically drained, and what should have been the greatest time of his life was keeping him from where he wanted to be, in the studio. He was 2 months into the middle of the biggest tour of his career, and it was taking its toll on him. "What do you do when you have the number one album, number one single, and number one movie?" questioned Revolution drummer Bobby Z. Rivkin. "I mean, there's just nowhere to go." Revolution bassist Mark Brown, a.k.a. Brown Mark, agreed. "What happens is you reach the mountain peak, and where do you go from there? And that's what happened to the whole band, the Revolution with Prince. It's like we reached this pinnacle of success, where we were to a point where we were saying to ourselves, 'Wow, what do we do now?' And Prince, he was already two albums down the road, and we haven't even finished the Purple Rain tour yet." Prince had many projects planned, and being on the road ultimately had to take a back seat to his studio work. According to Prince, "If you tour too much as an artist, you will burn up all your energy." Although few outside of his purple bubble realized it at the time, Prince had already packed his parachute to get out of the Purple Rain era and was excited to move on. The music he was playing from Purple Rain was relatively new to his fans, but he'd been focusing on these songs for a year and a half, and his reach as an artist had expanded beyond that project. Even though his album was launched slightly more than 5 months earlier, he'd already completed work on the follow-up, Around the World in a Day, and expected it to be released in spring. He was also planning the music for his next project, the second album by percussionist Sheila E., as well as deciding on the direction of his career after Purple Rain. But before that, he had a tour to complete. Music is often recorded in a vacuum with no knowledge of how it will be received by the audience. Every song is a Hail Mary thrown down the field, hoping that there is someone who catches what the performer was feeling and runs with it. Studio work can be a solitary experience, especially for Prince, who generally recorded alone. So the road seems like it would be an amazing contrast filled with adulation and glory. When it goes well, it qualifies as a victory lap that allows musicians to connect with their fans. But when certain levels of success are reached, the freedoms experienced before often turn claustrophobic. It is just another week filled with security guards, the low-frequency hum of a limo or van, and a new place to sleep in a city that can't be experienced, dictated by a strict, unforgiving clock controlled by someone else. Successful artists at this point in their careers have a choice. Do they stay in the confining prison of their hotel rooms waiting for their 2 hours of loving feedback? Or find a way to play music without the immediate response from a crowd? Prince decided to take every opportunity to make new music, but it was always limited by a tour schedule that could not easily be altered. "He was restless and bored by halfway through the tour," revealed his keyboard player, Matt Dr. Fink Fink. Prince sat us all down in the dressing room and said, "Well, I'm taking 2 years off after this." We all said, "Really? 2 years? And he said, "Yep. And you all can do whatever you want. Take a break, do solo records, take a vacation, whatever you want to do. And you're still going to be on retainer." We were all excited about that in a way. But I thought to myself, wait a minute. We're not going to Europe to do Purple Rain? or Japan or Australia? And he goes, no. That disappointed me. I thought, you should be milking the hell out of this. You should be touring the world with this and stay out for a year and do the U.S. even more. And he just said, no, because he hated being on the road. 6 months was his limit. He burnt out after that. I said, take a break for a month and then we'll go out and do some more. And he just didn't want to do it. I've never understood that to this day, why he didn't do that. Yeah, I think he got bored. And he would get bored on other tours too, adds fellow Revolution keyboard player Lisa Coleman. He would get sick of singing I Want to Be Your Lover. And I witnessed him go through cycles of that, like, I never want to sing that song again. And he just moved really quickly. It's wild because when he did hit that success with Purple Rain, he was too bored to do what you needed to do. You need to do the work and sustain it and stay on the road for a year because it doesn't just go away. It sort of like bubbles up and down and up and down for like the next year. And artists, for the most part, they'll stay out for a year and support that record. And each single as it comes out does its thing. But Prince was like, I will love you forever. Or would you believe 6 months? The tour was the biggest of his career. But there were compromises that were out of his control. He'd originally envisioned The Time, his rival band from Purple Rain, joining him on the road. But lead singer Morris Day left the group and parted ways with Prince, causing the band to break up. Some of the remaining members had been consolidated into The Family, a new band he was grooming that had a lot of potential. But their album was not complete, and they had never played live, so they didn't qualify as the opening spot. This created an opportunity for Sheila E., whose debut album, The Glamorous Life, garnered great reviews, but most people had no idea that he'd written, produced, and oversaw just about everything on her album. By all accounts, Prince lived to make music, and new music was his lifeblood. Touring and playing the same music every night, although financially rewarding, was a repetitive life that he didn't always enjoy. According to band member Lisa, the extreme highs and lows could all happen within the span of a few hours. I can remember a couple of times standing in the wings waiting to go on, and we'd hear the screaming start. As a band, we'd look at each other, contorting from the screaming, and plug our ears and wonder, what the hell is this? It was incredible. But then, at the end of the night, we'd be back in the quiet zone and thinking about what was going on in the world. It was a very bizarre life. It was like nothing else. Regardless of the craziness of the road, there was also a certainty about it. The positive aspect of a regimented schedule that had to be kept was the daily chance to jam with his hand-picked team of musicians and the opportunity to create. Prince was surrounded with a road-tested team of people who were all there to accommodate what he wanted. It circles back to the whole idea of his work ethic, explains Robert Cubby Colby, who ran the soundboard during his concerts. If he was going to work that hard every day, he certainly was going to surround himself with the people that were going to contribute, to work the hardest. Despite appearances, Prince did things for reasons, and he surrounded himself with those he trusted. And at this moment in his life, the Revolution was his family. It was the human, normal side of Prince that reached out to create the Revolution, explained Lisa. Every one of us is an interesting breed of person. There's a naive quality about us that lent itself to our loyalty to Prince. We were totally dedicated to working as hard as he did. We were like his kids. We could do right and we could do wrong. We could make him proud or we could make him mad. It was set up for us like that psychologically. The Revolution was his first band that actually had a name known to the public. But there was likely a reason for that. Until this last album, Prince had a tight band but didn't allow them to maintain full billing with him. It would always be Prince at the front, but with the five people who worked with him from Purple Rain to Parade, Bobby Z, Dr. Fink, Brown Mark, Lisa Coleman, and Wendy Melvoin. He acknowledged something in each of them that he felt deserved to be recognized, according to Coleman. He saw each of us like a band in our own right. Like Mark was the funk band, Matt was the synth band, Wendy's the funky Joni Mitchell, I'm the girl thing. It was like he was in the studio with all his influences, and whether it was a girly song, a ballad, or some hot, funky rock thing, he could deliver. Sonically and visually, I believe Prince knew that we were all aspects of himself, agreed Wendy. Musically, though, that translated in a singular way when playing together. I might never have been comfortable with wearing lingerie, but I was comfortable being his female counterpart on stage. That was important to him.
I think we were like the cast of the original Star Wars, with a Han Solo, a Princess Leia, and someone had to be a Chewbacca,
Brown Mark jokingly described the band members to Wax Poetics magazine. He had us blocked and staged in his imagination. Purple Rain had sold more albums than all of his previous albums combined, and the movie locked in their importance to Prince and their relationship with him. So with this new exposure, there were literally millions of new fans around the world, and to the majority of that new audience, it was, and always would be, Prince and the Revolution.
Tuesday, January 1st, 1985. Venue: Reunion Arena, Dallas, Texas. Capacity: 18,276. Sold out.
Prince was a teacher every day. He would be able to tell if that student was getting the homework from the night before, or the day before, or the show before. He just had his own way of knowing that. Either you knew what to do, or you didn't know what to do. You needed to be ahead of the game.
Robert Cubby Colby.
As soon as Prince and the band finished the final encore, the crew began breaking down the stage and packing it for the next city. In general, Prince wasn't patient, but when it came to the road crew, he was a little more tolerant. Regardless of Prince's demanding work ethic, he understood that there was a machine that worked behind him, and the road team wasn't following Prince. He was often following them after they had worked all night. He knew what we were up against, says Colby. He knew what the lighting crew team was up against every day, how difficult it was to load in this mammoth Roy Bennett production and this mammoth sound system and get this all right. And then he'd want to rehearse at 3 in the afternoon. We'd have 9 trucks to unload. It's only 8 in the morning, but we'd make it happen. We'd make it happen to the point where he'd go in and say, Cubby, can I play my guitar? Sorry, Prince, not ready yet. The worst thing you could say was yes when it was not ready. We'd say, Prince, we'll take the purple piano to your dressing room, okay? That was much safer and better. There wasn't anything to it. We had multiples of everything. It wasn't a problem. It was just proactive thinking. He'd walk in the door. He would very seldom go to his own dressing room. He just went to his playground, and that was the stage. But the stage wasn't the only option he'd have when he felt the need to record. What we would do is have a mobile truck in some of the biggest cities like Los Angeles, New Orleans, Dallas, and New York, explains his recording engineer, Susan Rogers. Most of the time, at least during the Purple Rain tour, he'd come off stage and go over to a recording studio on the road. Prior to that tour, I had a big, thick directory of studios across the country, so it was my job to take road cases with tapes in them on the road with us, because we were making Sheila's record and recording for Prince as well. So I'd have to go into that directory, find local studios, and see the brief little summaries of who's recorded there, maybe what equipment they had. I'd call these folks up and say, Do you have an opening? Can you take a special client tonight? Can you take Prince tonight? Who does that? Who can make a record for another artist while they are on tour? It is just an unimaginable amount of work. But that is what he did.
Thursday, January 3rd, 1985. Venue: The Omni, Atlanta, Georgia. Capacity: about 17,500. Sold out.
We're giving away a lot of money. I found out recently that money is sort of like blood. If you hoard it and keep it all tied up amongst yourself, you sooner or later get sick. So we just try to keep it in circulation.
Prince.
One of the most overlooked elements of Prince's career was his charity work. For the 5 shows at the Omni, Prince designated 482 Purple Circle seats for $50, and the proceeds helped fund Marva Collins West Side Preparatory School in Chicago. Without Prince's money, there would be no institute,
explained Marva in 1986. Multiply the first 200 teachers.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?